A few years ago, we paid a visit to New York's Jones Beach, one of the most popular state parks in America, with more visitors than Yellowstone and Yosemite combined. It's about an hour outside Manhattan on the south shore of Long Island, and we found a lot of kids digging in the sand.
There are like little fish, and there are shells that move and dig underground.
You mean clams?
Yeah.
People come from all over, for Jones Beach is famous for offering...
Built in 1929 for $15 million, it was a marvel, designed by Robert Moses to look like an ocean liner, all boardwalks and amphitheaters for late-night concerts. I say was because Jones Beach was badly damaged by Hurricane Sandy. The only good news for those who opposed him was that Donald Trump has now abandoned his much-litigated bid to build a huge restaurant on the beach. As one state official said, Sandy has opened everyone's eyes to the risks of building on the oceanfront. So, what happens now? Can New York rebuild its public space? What about its private spaces? Judith Rodin is president of the Rockefeller Foundation and co-chair of the New York State 2100 Commission, one of four commissions created by Governor Andrew Cuomo to come up with answers to those questions, and they did in a very large report. And Judith joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Judith, that question, you know, whether or not to rebuild, is in the news.
Well, the governor just announced the implementation of one of the recommendations of our report, and that is an effort to buy out homeowners who live in the floodplain zones. We need to consider on these floodplain areas whether we need to encourage people to move out. The Rockefeller Foundation worked in New Orleans after Katrina, and of course that was a very hot-button question there as well.
Well, and you speak of this proposal from Andrew Cuomo, spending up to $400 million to buy these homes damaged by Sandy, demolish them, keep the land undeveloped. This is called managed retreat from the shore. Those from this area, I mean, you don't have to be from this area. Any part of the country knows that if there's an area where your family has lived for generations, if you're lucky enough to have a toehold near the ocean, it makes you one of the wealthiest people in the world, even if you're not, you know. Do you really think people are going to buy into that?
Here's, I think, the answer. The answer is that there's no single approach. There have to be multiple solutions. There's the rebuilding of the natural, whether it's dunes or other kinds of natural barriers and protection, and that may enable people to stay where they are more successfully. There also has to be a much smarter retreat. We have not managed and redone a lot of the floodplain mapping around the country, and that is going on now really intensively. Think about it this way. What's going to happen is insurance companies will keep raising the rate. Public policy will have to determine who's going to guarantee those increased rates if people can't afford them. Or do we create more natural open spaces the way things used to be and allow people to rebuild close but not exactly in the most vulnerable places? That, I think, is one of the public policy questions of the 21st century.
Yeah.
And we at Rockefeller keep talking about the need to build more resilient infrastructure. We've got to be able to rebound more quickly, more effectively from these climate-related events because they're no longer black swans. They're not happening once a century. They're happening every year in some part of the country.
The black swan, the phrase that's used for that kind of catastrophe that happens only once in a lifetime, financial or weather or otherwise. But just staying with this thought of this managed retreat, is the state considering seizing the property? And then just in the same context, these public places, would you consider closing those as public beaches and making them, as you say, sort of a barrier as opposed to rebuilding the beautiful boardwalks and the beach houses?
Well, the answer to those very important questions is no to both. Our commission recommended incentives. The offer that's on the table is the guaranteed pre-storm price plus bonuses the more vulnerable the area is, plus an even greater bonus if everyone on a single street decides to do it. You know, when you see the boardwalks blown down in the Far Rockaways, Jones Beach and the others, you know, there's rebuilding. It's where people live.
Yeah.
Alabama, we've now rebuilt a coastline in Alabama four times with billions of FEMA dollars. Why do we do this? The recommendations are, and I think, again, we want to see this everywhere in the country where there's fragile coastlines and fragile ecologies, to restore the natural elements to those coastlines, rebuild better dunes, plant better beach grass, put oyster beds, which in the shallows in front of some of those areas, so that you get both the effects of pollution control, because oyster beds are wonderful filtration mechanisms, as well as slowing down waves under big surges. So there's a number of natural solutions that really restore the elegance and sort of wonderful quality of some of those strips of land the way they used to be, to build vulnerability in the interest of development, whether it's economic development or housing development. I'm reminded when I work on these issues of what happened in the Bangkok floods last year. The reason that Bangkok flooded so badly was that in the interests of economic development, they built over the natural canals that had really drained Bangkok for centuries, and they built highways because they were developing new parts of the city economically. We can't make financial and economic decisions without really understanding the environmental impact, particularly as the effects of climate change grow.
You mentioned oyster beds. They used to be all over New York Harbor, hence you have towns like Oyster Bay. But because of over-harvesting and then pollution, they were wiped out. We talked to Walter Priest. He's the habitat restoration specialist for NOAA. He said, yes, this could work, but only, as you've been saying, part of a puzzle. You know, it's not the definitive answer. But we know that areas that did invest in this kind of replenishment fared better during Sandy than communities that didn't. I mean, areas that brought back salt marshes along the coast.
Absolutely. And Robin, we have a classic example in Far Rockaway. As you said, it's one of those strips along the south shore of Long Island and New York City. And the Army Corps of Engineers recommended about 4 or 5 years ago raising the level of the sand dunes as surge barriers. But there's a great deal of local autonomy in each individual village, incorporated village in New York. And so 5 of those communities decided to allow it and 2 did not. And I walked the Rockaways after Hurricane Sandy, and to see the devastation in the 2 communities that didn't have the higher sand dunes as compared to those that had elected to do it really convinces me that we're going to have to restore some of these natural ecosystems because they are part of the protective solution.
That's Judith Rodin, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and one of the commissioners appointed to look at changes New York should make in the wake of Superstorm Sandy. So, would you sell your home on the shore? Pay more in taxes to build, say, a seagate? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, more on that seagate in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Judith Rodin, co-chair of the New York State Commission tasked with limiting damage from the next Hurricane Sandy. She's also president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Her report is titled Recommendations to Improve the Strength and Resilience of the Empire State's Infrastructure. And Judith, we talked about some of the suggestions, the plan to buy back homes on the coast, to build so-called soft infrastructure ecosystems along the shore. Let's move to hard infrastructure. What are some of the suggestions to keep water out?
Inflatable balloons for tunnels that will also help the subway system in New York City, a number of gates that go down, vents that can close automatically. New York struggled, and New Jersey too, terribly, as a result of not having enough fuel for automobiles and trucks and airplanes for a while. All of that was because of the flooding in the Port of New York. Another element in building resilience is to be able to fail safely so that one failure doesn't take everything else down. That's going to be very important when we talk about energy grids. The whole wonderful idea behind building smart grids is that they don't depend on a single energy source, for example, fuel, but they link together a variety of energy sources. When one fails, the others can take over.
So you talk about make sure that energy is generated in diverse locations. And this is not just Manhattan. Again, what your report talks about, the Empire State, and that's the beach towns of Long Island, that's Manhattan and its harbors, but that's upstate. We're reminded that there's oil storage tanks on a floodplain way upstate in Binghamton, New York.
Absolutely. And they were compromised for a while after Hurricane Irene last year. In fact, one of the things that our commission recommends is a regional stockpiling of critical parts, because often these parts take weeks to order after the emergency occurs.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason that people are so compromised for so long. We can keep putting billions and billions of dollars into FEMA, and we will certainly need to do that, or we can invest in the kind of infrastructure that's more preventive and more resilient so that ultimately we really can recover more rapidly from those shocks that we can't predict.
Part of the investment is investing in workers, training workers who actually know what to do in this situation. But that raises the question of the cost of all of this. And one of the most costly suggestions, and it's still in the hard infrastructure fix, is this idea of barriers and movable sea gates that would stretch across narrow waterways. We're reminded of why they call the Verrazzano Bridge the Verrazzano Narrows, because it's over this body of water that narrows as it goes towards the Hudson River. And there's a suggestion of putting a gate there. But then there are these huge sea gates. They're used in Rotterdam in the Netherlands and London. Apparently, there's one in Stamford, Connecticut. But if I'm looking at your report correctly, I'm on page 124. There's one that would stretch from New Jersey all the way across to New York to the Far Rockaways. That looks huge.
This is the only recommendation where we say further study should be done. But on these floodgates, on these huge pieces, no one has studied the impact of the amount of water that would be displaced by doing it. Water will have to go somewhere. And so if it protects lower Manhattan and upper New Jersey and the beginning of Long Island, what happens to southern New Jersey and the rest of Long Island? Because it's so expensive, we really do say, let's study it more.
How would it work? Would it be open and then it would at some point close, slide closed?
Exactly. It's three separate gates. One or all three would close as the water started coming in. When there was no storm surge, they would be open and you would have naturally flowing water. Whether and how it would work at that scale is still not widely known.
You figure out whether you're going to use it, and then presumably people get hired to use it if it's needed. We know that there were other disaster commissions after Hurricane Irene, after Hurricane Katrina. The New York State Assembly produced a report warning about New York City's failures. Yet a lot of the recommendations went ignored. I'm remembering a quote from, I think, a New York Times article about how Goldman Sachs, somehow people at Goldman Sachs remembered and knew to sandbag their entrances. Nobody sandbagged the tunnels and the hospitals. Who makes sure that this all gets carried out?
Our commission recommends a statewide risk officer who would both integrate across all the agencies of government so that not only would there be somebody in charge, but we would have a more integrated response. Often one agency doesn't necessarily know what the other's doing, both in terms of investment, but also in terms of response. Part of building responsive, resilient systems is getting information in a coordinated way in real time when you can do something about it, not 4 days later when you learn that everybody's basement is still flooded. So a chief risk officer could be in charge of this kind of coordinated information feedback. And now we have the technology, real-time information that would allow that to happen as well. You know, you asked, and you mentioned Goldman Sachs, you asked about financing. A key recommendation in the report, and a critical part of this for the United States, is going to be how to bring the private sector into funding some of this infrastructure. We're recommending a New York State infrastructure bank. We at Rockefeller have been working with the governors of California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia to create what they're calling the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. a mechanism for how you create the framework to allow public-private partnerships.
So you have this bank to sort of stockpile money to pay for this. You know, how much will translate into not just recommendations, but law? For instance, some sort of requirement that boilers and electrical equipment not be put on the first floor, the basement of a building, but have to go on the third floor.
You keep coming back to the question of, are we going to implement the recommendations? Do we have the right kind of political will? Well, the will also comes from the will of the public. We need to teach people what their responsibility is as part of this package if we're really going to have the transformative impact that we'll need to have.
That's Judith Rodin, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Some fascinating ideas. Judith, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, still ahead today. The crime rate recently ticked up in New York. The cause? Apple picking. Thieves there and elsewhere looking for Apple products. That story after the latest news here and now.